You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
My guest today is Gilbert Sorrentino, and we're talking to him up in his home in Stanford, California. I think of him as being a retiring generator of these remarkable machine-tooled texts. He won't come down here to Los Angeles to read or to talk to me, and yet from the Dalkey Archive Press now, every few months, nearly every year, I guess, but with republications, we have his Under the Shadow, his completion of his trilogy, Mysterioso, along with Rose Theater and Odd Number. I guess this all started with the imaginative qualities of actual things and his incredible book of Rambeau-inspired prose poems, Splendide Hotel. But I think that Gilbert Sorrentino is, with this novel, Under the Shadow, the unquestionable inventor of a strange and savage kind of novel, very funny, very mysterious. And I guess I'll begin by asking you, Gil, about this new series of tableaus. What was the origin of Under the Shadow?
Under the Shadow is derived from a series of drawings that were made for Raymond Roussel's final book, New Impressions of Africa. The history of these drawings is rather interesting indeed, I had been looking at these drawings for, I would say, a good 5 or 6 years in the Pauvert edition, in which all the drawings are grouped together at the back of the book. There are 59 of them. And I'd been looking at these drawings for about 5 or 6 years, and every time I looked at them, I looked at them hundreds of times, and every time I looked at them, they seemed more mysterious and more evocative and stranger and more profound than they seemed the time before. The story of these drawings is very interesting. Roussel's poem to him, when he finished it, seemed as if it would not make a fat enough or thick enough book for the marketplace. So what he wanted to do was bulk the book up, and in order to bulk the book up, he decided that he would hire an illustrator to make 59 drawings, which would go into the book in between the cantos, or in between, let's say, certain sections of the poem. The interesting thing about this, he hired a guy named H.A. Zoe, and he hired him through a private detective agency. He never met Zoe, and Zoe never met Roussel. And he gave explicit instructions to Zoe that he wanted 59 drawings, but he would not tell Zoe what they were for, nor did he let Zoe see the book for which the drawings were to serve as illustrations. This didn't matter anyway, because what Roussel ultimately did was use the drawings in a book in which all the pages, of course, were uncut. And what Roussel wanted the owner of the book to do, because the book was so laid out this way and so printed this way, the poems appeared on the right hand, the stanzas of the poems appeared on the right hand pages only. The left hand pages of the book were blank, and then, of course, the next right-hand page would have a continuation of the poem. In between these pages, the uncut were the uncut pages, and the drawings were inside. So, in other words, if you owned a copy of this book, Roussel was not really interested whether you looked at the drawings or not. The drawings are simply there to make the book fatter. In any event, these drawings are the drawings of what you might call a hack artist, and an artist working absolutely in the dark. The marvelous thing about these drawings, though, is that all by themselves, they are incredibly dark, mysterious, funny, ludicrous, absolutely opaque. In other words, you don't know really what's going on in the drawing. And each one seems to tell some sort of odd story. And as I say, I've been looking at these drawings for at least 5 years, and it occurred to me that it might be interesting to see if one could make a book out of the drawings. In other words, just looking at the drawings and deciding what it is these drawings evoked. And so, that's how Under the Shadow came.
So it is the missing book which these illustrations once would have illustrated. It is the shadow of Roussel's book.
Well, one would like to think that, except that, of course, the drawings in no way fit Roussel's poem. They don't have anything to do with it. But what really is happening here is that this is really sort of what I've tried to do, I think, or what I think I like to have done is to have made a book which is a book that Roussel might have written.
Yes, I think so. You know, it really is, of your recent things, the most uninterruptedly funny that I've seen.
Yeah, a lot of people have said it's quite funny. A lot of people have also been rather spooked by it.
Well,
it's
funny and dismaying and beautiful, like Roussel. I think someone once described the process of reading Raymond Roussel as being like the process of feeding passion fruit to robots.
Right.
I'm curious about what attracts you to Roussel, since he is a writer, by your own admission, who is infuriating.
Oh, yes, indeed. I think it's the purity of the prose is really what it is. I mean, Roussel wants you to read his prose, and there's nothing underneath the prose. The prose itself carries all the mystery. This has always appealed to me. This appeals to me in almost any writer. I like writers who are superficial, and I don't mean to use that term derogatorily or in any denigrative manner. I really believe that the world is this way, so I like writers who are this way. I mean, I don't think that the world has a meaning which is sort of like underneath it, and we have to dig to find out the truth of what's going on in the world. I think the most mysterious thing about being alive is that all the mystery and terror and beauty and horror of the world that we don't really understand is in front of us. I mean, we look at it all the time. It's just that we don't recognize it. We can't see it right. We only see it once in a while in, let's say, great flashes of perception. We suddenly see the truth of something. Well, I like books that work that way, too. I'm not interested in books that, in a sense, are simply there and they're saying to you, what you're reading is not the true message. The true message lies beneath these words. What you have to do is, like, dig out the true message. I don't like books like that. I like books in which everything is right there on the surface, except that the text is, in a sense, daring you to recognize it, is really what's happening.
Well, also daring you to acknowledge that whatever process created these perplexing surfaces is as unknowable, ultimately, unless the author says, as what were the purposes, if any, of God's creation, so that we have to be satisfied by the superficial.
Oh, yes, I agree indeed, absolutely. The point is, it seems to me, the point is that it's a great deal of pleasure for an artist to make something if he's working in terms of, let's say, a constraint that he himself has invented, because then what's happening is that you're working toward a goal. In other words, you're trying to realize your constraint. So you're working toward a goal, but the point is you have no idea what it's going to look like when you get there. You have absolutely no idea. In other words, I didn't know what Under the Shadow was going to look like when it was finished, because if you look at the drawings by H.A. Zhou, you discover that none of them have anything to do one with the other, except in some curious way they hang together in odd ways. And there are people who appear in, let's say, the fifth drawing, or a person who appears in the fifth drawing, who doesn't reappear in any of the drawings, except in curious ways he does reappear. In other words, there's somebody in a drawing, let's say the 28th drawing, there's somebody in that drawing who could be the person in the fifth drawing, let's say 30 years earlier, or 10 years later. But they don't look alike, but they're doing something which looks as if, right, it could have something to do with, like, the person in the fifth drawing. So if you use these 59 drawings as a constraint, in other words, you have to, like, You have to achieve the book by filling out the secret meaning of the drawings, what they're telling you superficially. You don't know what the book is going to look like until it's there.
Now I'm talking to...
And that's, I think, the pleasure of it.
I'm talking to Gilbert Sorrentino, the author of Under the Shadow. Now, there are sub-constraints or subsystems here in this book as well. I suspect there are, at any rate. Are there not?
If you'll make it that clearer, I'll be able to answer you.
Well, for instance, in the third or fourth paragraph of each section, there's a list of fragments and an assemblage of mysterious memories that the person locked in the thought within the tableau reveals. They're all very funny. They're discontinuous. But I began to think, are there... rules for the writing of each internal section?
No, there are no rules, but there are three or four themes which persist in the book. One is, of course, the vision of three girls in white,
uh-huh,
who seem to be waiting in a dark lake far out somewhere in the country. Another is a glimpse of a half-naked woman seen through a window, rather obscure. You can barely make her out. And there are a couple of other thematic elements like that which persist throughout the book. But those are simply things that have been called up by the attention to the details of the various drawings. And as they have been called up out of my own unconscious is really where they've come from, which is another, I think, interesting thing that occurs when one uses, let's say, a device or a constraint in order to make a book. What is happening is that although it would seem as if the use of a constraint would tend to narrow one's possibilities of writing, what you discover is that the more narrowly you set your parameters, as it were, the deeper you go. And what happens is that you begin to tap into your unconscious, which could never be tapped into, let's say, if you didn't use a constraint. It just wouldn't happen that way.
I've been talking to Gilbert Sorrentino, the author of Under the Shadow, a book of remarkable, mysterious, beautiful, funny prose published by Dalkey Archive Press. Thank you for being with us, Gilbert.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Gilbert Sorrentino will be making one of his rare reading appearances at 7:30 on Tuesday, March 2nd, 1993, in the Lannan Readings and Conversations series at the Pacific Design Center. My next guest is Kelvin Christopher James, the author of a book of short stories called Jumping Ship, published by Villard Books. You know, this book comes to me much heralded because its editor, Doug Stumpf, began talking to me about some of these stories over a year ago when I first met him at the Squaw Valley Writers Conference. And since Doug had been the editor who discovered Michael Chabon, I was particularly eager to see these stories. Tell me, you were born in Trinidad. When did you come to America?
About 15 years ago.
And when did you start writing?
1980, January the 1st. That's the exact day that I gave up my job in the hospital and decided to take up writing as a full-time vocation.
You were working as a research scientist?
Since at 14. I have a long story in that regard. At 14 or so, I left school. My mother took me out of school and got me a job with a research scientist, a guy named Gaston Percival Blais. He was working on coconut disease, and he made me his assistant, me being the hands and the feet, him being the brain. And I learned the science that way from him. And moving from that early introduction and a love of science from that point of view, I won a scholarship into UWI, and I did science, a bachelor's of science, and with honors in chemistry and zoology. And then I taught science again for 2 years in high school. Then I immigrated up here to America, and then went to Columbia University and did a master's of science, an MA, and then a doctorate in education from Columbia University, all the while working in Harlem Hospital as a supervisor of the chemistry lab. So that's my sort of science background and grounding. But then in 1980, I jumped ship. And I decided to follow this pursuit, this desire. I have always had this yearning to write fiction, right? Probably to meet people, to tell a story. Maybe it's just plain exhibitionism or something like that. But I really have a drive to tell stories and to make stories. And I love language. I've been reading since I'm a little child and read every single thing you could name, you know, from Shakespeare to the Bible to Frank Yerby, who died recently, I understand. And Alexander Dumas, the science fiction guys, Alfred Bester.
I love Alfred Bester.
P.G. Woodhouse, another guy who... I read everything, and I figured after a while I could write these stories. And it was just in 1980 that I sort of had the big push. I had that great drive to actually jump into it, and I did it.
Did you ever read the Caribbean novelist Wilson Harris?
No.
Who were the writers of...
From the Caribbean?
Yes.
One of the earliest writers was Edgar Mittelhose. I read him. He's a Guyanese fellow, and he wrote a lot of that. It's interesting, the Quarantine Thunder is a name comes to mind. I don't know why. But he really marveled in that whole exotic quality of tropical life, Caribbean tropical life. Just the scenery was so dense, just the stuff he would talk about. And the combinations of people, that's another thing that he touched on, that whole, mixture of bloods and peoples and cultures and so on. And after him, of course, is Naipaul. Me being Trinidadian, I had to read Naipaul. He was one of my heroes. Miguel Street, for particular reference, was really good to me.
I love that book. It's so good about towns.
It is so good. That's just the point. It's a good book. And then after that, we have Samuel Salvan. He's a fellow I read. And Lovelace and Braffett. There are a few West Indians, but you see, I tend to read people as, as writers, you know, kind of the genre, the kind of story, an adventure story or a cowboy western or a romance story or a mystery. Or short stories on the whole, in horror or in science fiction or whatever, rather than if they're West Indian or if they're Latin American and so on. I mean, I've done that because I had to, but I don't respect that practice so much. I don't respect the practice of being a black writer and a white writer and a woman writer. I think people write about issues, they write about feelings, they try to present pictures of what's going on as best as they could, you know, and... to define it, to color-code it, it's a mess, you know.
Your writing is so sexy. I mean, the first thing that a reader is going to find in Jumping Ship by Kelvin Christopher James is a sense of lusty anticipation. The first pages have a young boy looking out at a giant orange waiting for him on a tree. Another is a... boy taking a scholarship examination, so stimulated by the proctor that he has to sexually relieve himself before the exam is done. You do for succulents and fruits, mm-hmm. sort of what Colette did. You know, you're the great evoker of flora and.
It's a turn on one way or the other, and I felt just the name of the story even, and the subject matter is a bit taboo, being this masturbation thing, and I wanted to make a pure story. Even the language of the boy at that age, you're very florid in your way of thinking, your way of seeing the world. So this is a sort of language I have to put in, combined with the scenery, just the setting and the subject matter. It has to be a succulent story in how it's presented to.
Well, I've never seen in any book I've read over the last year as much drooling.
Because that happens to people when they lose their wits and to the will of that sensuality. When you lose it, you drool, you slurp. Hopefully you enjoy yourself.
Tell me, you know, you seem to have been... evolving as a writer in New York on the East Side scene. I know you've published in Between C and D and Bomb. How does one make it evolve, enter the writing world?
It's really a luck and chance thing. Because my story is an unusual one. Most of my stories, even my life story, is really unusual in that way, that things just happen on a spur in time, sort of. I began writing. I jumped into this thing in 1980, as I said. The first story I wrote was Ties. End of 1980, I had it written and I had revised it enough and so on. And in 1981, it was published in Columbia University Magazine. Just like that, a friend took it, that sort of thing. Well, that made me feel really encouraged, and, you know, Kelvin was in. Until 1989, another success. I spent 9 years with no success, and that was the New York Foundation for the Arts Fellowship, which I won, again because a friend pushed me to enter in it, because I had given up on sending in stories. I got glowing rejections. Oh, you have a great voice, it's wonderful what you're doing, but our magazine can't use your stuff. And that's never stopped me in a way, because they were so flattering in a way. And many of these editors and sub-editors would write me long letters, you know, like an explanation why and how much they admired the work. So it was still a bit of encouragement.
This collection is divided sort of sharply between the stories of the island and the stories of the city. Is there a stylistic difference, do you feel, in them as well?
The scenery is clearly the thing. The environment of the story is starker, and you have to go much more into, I feel I have to present much more the person's innermost drives, sort of, and present it almost pictorially by action than anything else. Whereas in the Caribbean stories, the scenery, the background is so evocative on its own, I find I can make references to the person's character and the traits they might be following just by mentioning, just by talking about how the background is. The background is so strong. So it becomes almost like a character in the story, the backgrounds in the Caribbean stories.
Some of the response to Jumping Ship is that the book is not interested in being politically correct.
Well,
can you speak a bit about that?
Yeah, that's me. I'm not interested. I've always done this. This is my life. I believe there are things we must talk about. We must be serious in anything we're doing. As a scientist, I was looking out for information to solve red ring disease for anybody in the world. That was my audience. You know, at that time, a hero was Isaac Newton. He's a guy who was discovering, as he did with gravity and mechanics and so on, for the world. When I got into arts and writing and fiction now, I'm investigating, in a way of speaking, human behavior for the world. There's no special audience. And so I'm not into this black-white thing at all. I think it's ridiculous. Human beings do what human beings have to do. I'm just trying to present it as truly as possible. And regarding the sort of stylistic things that I do, I'm not a learned writer. You know, I'm just expressing a talent that I have, that I'm developing by practice a lot. And so I don't feel constrained by any style or any body, any faction of writing. I write stuff, I'm so happy that people like it, because it's simple, you know. I want the stuff to be simple and accessible to people who like language, who like to see language as malleable, as something to enrich and to enlarge, and that could move you in itself. You know, that's what I want to do, and that's what's happening. So Kelvin couldn't be happier.
As an example, I thought I'd ask you to read a passage from the story Succulence, in which the hero finds himself in a secret garden, one he hasn't known before, because it gives the example of the quality of yearning and the quality of the erotic call. This is Kelvin Christopher James reading a passage from the story Succulence from his collection Jumping Ship.
As though sunstruck, Jared stood amazed at the sheer variety of fruit the garden presented. Like a fry in front, a hook-shaped worm, he greedily scrutinized his prospects. About him were sun-faced guavas, blackly ripe sweet and sour cherries, several other varieties of mangoes, fat guanabanas, 5 full-bunched yellow dwarf coconut palms, clusters of piwa palms, and more, and much more. Bright multi-globed graps of purples or salmon reds or varied browns interrupted like extravagant pastry decorations on the generally dark green leafy background. And he was plumb in the middle of the party's cake. He gaped about, making out what had to be a sapodilla tree with its sticky, juiced sweet fruit jutting directly from the stem like matte brown breasts. He doubted only because never before had he seen sapodilla so big, so fat, so promising juicy. The garden's abundant variety was incredible, yet Gerard sensed there was still more. Quite on its own, a smug, astonished, high-pitched giggle laughed out of him. But then, abruptly, at his own noise, before the rest of him could join the fun, his skin chilled and his hairs rose. And he became ultra alert. It had occurred to him all this was too grand to be so available. There had to be some hazard here. He slipped some spit around the mouth, suddenly dry, and edged nearer to the cooler canopy of the fruity arbor, tensing even more. The whole place seemed so waiting, too passive and quiet and biding like a trap. All the fruit, everything might be poised and ready like tasty bait. The only free movement in the arbor was the shafts of sunshine flickering hither-thither over the leaf-strewn ground like searching spotlights or fleeing eyes.
That was Kelvin Christopher James reading a passage from the story Succulents from his book Jumping Ship. Thank you very much for coming and joining me today, Kelvin.
It's my pleasure to be here.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineers were Bob Carlson, Theo Mondel, and Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books. Too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.